Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We start the show today by talking about the book Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology. And we're talking with the author, Jeff Wilson. He worked for more than 30 years in Wisconsin's North Woods, a lot of it for the DNR, and his life took him to six countries and five states, from the Arctic tundra to the mountains of Nepal. But he spent most of his career and his working life in Wisconsin's North Woods, and he has some fabulous stories to tell in his book. And as we talk with him today, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you've had some experiences with wildlife that are similar to Jeff's. Maybe you're interested in various conservation efforts. What are you involved in? You can give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jeff Wilson, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Larry. I'm honored to be here. Well, been a big fan of your show for many years.
I'll tell you what, Scott Craven sent me a note, and he said, you've got to get Jeff Wilson on your show, and if you haven't read his book yet, you've got to read his book. So I thought, well, if Scott Craven says that, I better do it. So we got a copy of the book, and I just loved the book, Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology. I had so much fun. It is it's a story kind of your working life, almost a memoir, you might call it. And there's so many funny things that happen to you. But at the same time, it's a long career that involved, I was just making a note, that you worked with many, many fabulous projects that really helped set up what our Wisconsin wildlife in Wisconsin's all about. Everything from trapping martens in Minnesota to start a colony here, trumpeter swan recovery program, osprey program, wolves, and of course a lot of your work was involved bears here in the state. So you cover the whole gamut, and it all started back in Iowa.
That's right, Larry. I grew up on a farm in Iowa, and from what I've heard, I think my upbringing may have been similar to yours. It was a small farm. Mom and Dad both worked on the farm, and you know, we had chickens and some milk cows and sheep and hogs, and you know, we kind of lived at the intersection of a gravel road.
Yeah,
we didn't. Back in those days, you didn't get to town all that often. Both mom and dad both worked there on the farm, and big garden, of course. But I think my love for wildlife kind of started then. And one of the stories I tell, you know, back then we had a lot of people come and visit the farm. You'd have your implement salesman, you'd have your Amway distributor that sold my mom the soaps and things she needed. The milkman came, of course, and gave us free butter from the creamery. But one day my mom and I are sitting at the table, and we heard a little skirmish on the porch, and all of a sudden the door flies open and in runs the Fuller brush salesman. He slams the door and he looks at me and at us and he yells, "There's a rabid fox out in the yard. It almost got me. Get a gun quick." Well, I got up and I went to the window and I looked out, and the salesman was standing beside me. Now, rabies back then, it was a mighty dangerous thing. There weren't, you know, we didn't vaccinate our dogs. I don't think there was a dog vaccine. Humans didn't have a vaccine. If you got bit by a rabid animal, and about every 10 years, you know, a few cases,
someone would,
raccoons or fox. And it was a serious matter. Well, anyway, I looked out the window and I said, "Don't worry, I know what to do." I then threw the door open and ran out and leaped off the porch and ran right out into the middle of the yard. And I did kind of a half circle, and that fox saw me, and it took off in hot pursuit. Well, I got about all the way around the circle, and that fox had caught up to me. Well, then I stumbled and fell and landed on my back. The fox leaped onto my chest. And so I just threw my arms around the fox and held, pinned him to me. And I kind of struggled back and forth and moved a little bit. And then I carefully sat up, still clutching the fox, and I picked up my pet fox, Zorro, and went over to the porch to show my mom and the salesman. My mom was furious because I pulled that stunt before. But Zorro was my pet fox back then. And not long after Zorro, I read a book by Sterling North. I think it was he's a Wisconsin author.
Yeah.
And his book titled Rascal. Of course, then I had to have a pet raccoon. And then later a neighbor gave me a pet descended skunk. Its name was Flower. But those wild animals, and by the way, it's totally illegal now to have a wild pet like that.
Yeah.
And I think that's for the better, obviously, especially from the animal's point of view. But back then, having those pets, I learned an awful lot about animal behavior. And like things Zorro, my fox, taught me, I later used to help me trap and radio collar gray wolves here in Wisconsin. I learned traits from that fox that I later did animal abatement work where when I had red fox depredating a woman's geese one time. So that's kind of where it all started. And then, of course, I went up north to college here in Wisconsin. And once I got up in the Northwoods and saw what we had up here, I didn't look back. And I've been here ever since.
Yeah, you have. Your first job, I believe, was in Park Falls as a wildlife technician. And your work, you know, a wildlife technician has a broad range of things to deal with. Because you're involved with all kinds of wildlife.
That's true, Larry. And that first job at Park Falls, you know, even with a college education, you learn an awful lot on the job. I mean, I had to learn how to blast with dynamite to resolve beaver dam problems. I had to learn how to age, like you said earlier, deer by looking at the presence and absence of certain molars and wear patterns. And I had to learn how to climb trees to band ospreys and eagles and erect osprey platforms. So I dedicated the book to my mentors, the wildlife technicians that kind of took me under their wing and taught me the ropes, so to speak. And there was quite a bit of overlap, actually, of what wildlife biologists did and what wildlife technicians did. But we, part of the book, I think the importance of the book is to let the general public know, just what do we do out there in the field? You know, I think a lot of people don't really realize what it's like to collect data for population modeling, to survey species, to handle animal damage, to work with landowners and the public. And I hope the book emphasizes a lot of that as well.
Well, it certainly does. And it's there are so many stories. We could spend 3 hours, I think, talking about the book and all the stories in it. There's one I wanted to, maybe another one to start with, just because it has some implications. You were doing some, you were banding ospreys, and you might give us the background on that, but you had an incident, the first time, I think it was, you and John Olson banded an osprey.
Yeah, that was a big day for us. You know, well, in 1982, the DNR finally established the Bureau of Endangered Resources, but they were poorly staffed and they didn't have very good budget. So we in the Bureau of Wildlife Management, we tried to help them out all we could. And, you know, in those days in the 80s, osprey hawks or osprey were endangered species. And we didn't know a lot about them, but we knew that by erecting platforms, which we did, and we learned how to climb these trees, and protecting the nest sites and doing nest management plans, that we could help in recover the population. And it did work. But we didn't know a lot about how many we were producing. We did some aerial flights, but they blend in so well. It's really hard to detect how many chicks are in a nest from the air. So John Olson and I, he was the manager here for the first 10 years I was in Mercer. He got a call from a man named Don Fallon. And Don won. He was the osprey guru of Wisconsin. And he's since passed away, but he wondered if we would be interested in having him come up and train us how to band ospreys. Well, I was probably in my late 20s, early 30s. John was the same age. And we were pretty excited about this. We thought, wow, this is an opportunity. We'd band geese and ducks and woodcock and a few things. But we really, you know, handling a raptor was going to be a first-time ordeal. And so we arranged for Don to come up. It was on a Saturday. And we started to prepare for this and got all our equipment ready. And one thing John pointed out to me was, Jeff, this is a really big opportunity. We can't blow this. We got to really look professional. So let's not ask too many questions. Let's listen to Don. It's an endangered species, after all, and we can't make a mistake. And John even said, hey, what do you say we wear our uniform shirts? These are those khaki shirts with a patch on the left shoulder, you know, with a DNR patch. And this is the shirt we usually wore when we went out and gave presentations to rod and gun clubs or school groups. Anyway, Don arrives, and we're tuned up for him. And it's a Saturday morning, and we prepared the boat. We decided the nest we were going to do was this one called North Bass Lake. We knew this nest like the back of our hand because it was on a platform, and we constructed that platform. We directed it. So Don arrives, and John drove the boat, and I rode with Don. And I hopped in the car, and immediately I could tell Don was the good old boy. He was my kind of guy. He was, the dash of the truck was covered with osprey feathers and bones and fishing tackle he'd found. And he was really devoted to this. Anyway, we get to the landing and look across, and there are the birds, several chicks in the nest. The adult is standing on the edge of the platform, kind of brooding them from the sun. And we go down and did the training. And once again, John kind of got me to the side and said, Jeff, let's really make this look professional. You know, we got a guy here with a master banding permit. And if we do it right, we'll be doing it forever, hopefully. Well, Don ran us through the procedures, showed us how to attach this lock-on band, which was special for ospreys. He told us how to handle them, you know, in case we have a jumper that's a little bit, wants to leave the nest a little early. And how to watch where it lands. He gave us a wire kind of operation with a hook on it. If you have one on the edge of the nest, to kind of hook its legs and coax it over. And so we listened contentedly and took it all in. And I didn't ask too many questions. And boy, things were looking good. I could tell John was really happy. We were really looking professional. So we get in the boat, and I'm driving the boat. Don's in the middle and John's in the bow. And we agreed not to speak at all because we don't want to stress these birds. And so we get across the lake, we land quietly, tie up, we handed up all our gear, laid out our climbing gear. We put our harnesses on. I attached the rope to John because he was going to go up first. We decided to both climb this nest, because there was room up there for two people. And after all, it was our first birds. And if something went wrong, we had another person there to help. And so Don stuck the bands in John's pocket, and we put our climbing irons on, our spurs. John went up first. He had the rope on him, of course. And I was below him about 5 feet. And so up we go. It's about 60 feet to the nest. So up we go, 10 feet, 20 feet. Finally, we get in where there's a lot of branches, so we had good handholds. But you couldn't see much but straight up because it was kind of a dark. There was trees all around us. It's kind of a dark tunnel to the top. And I just followed the rope. And when we got up about 50 feet, at least I estimated that, the rope stopped. but I kept climbing, and also I bumped into something, and I realized it was John Olson's rear end. And so I was right up by him. I hadn't seen him there. And I looked up, and John, I looked into his face, and it was just ashen. There was, he looked really worried. And I thought, oh my gosh, has something terrible happened? Has he been, taloned by an adult, or did he run into a wasp nest or something? And as I got closer, I stretched my neck up, and John stretched his down, and I said, what's the matter? And John says, wrong tree. Well, to my left, and I could see about 30 foot away, a nest of ospreys. The chicks were looking at us like, who are these idiots? So at that point, we realized there went our chance to impress Don Fallon. So down we go. We didn't even drop a rope to descend with our descending operation. We just climbed down. I stood to the side. John, when he hit the ground, he walked over to the correct tree. Up we went, and everything went just fine. But as I walked by Don Fallon, he said, what's the matter? And I said, wrong tree. He says, oh, that's happened to me before, too. Well, when we got back to the ground, birds were banded. We got in the boat. We still haven't said a word. We get about halfway across the lake, and all of a sudden, we all three just started laughing. In fact, we banded all that day, and all day long, we periodically would start laughing. And it was just so funny how we had blown it. Don is a funny guy, and he told that story often, but that was my first experience.
And that's the title of the book, Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology. Our guest today, the author, Jeff Wilson. It's fun talking with him. He's got lots of stories he can tell. That was a good one. Clara Neipert, by the way, is our producer. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Jeff Wilson. He is the author of Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology, talking about his career in northern Wisconsin as a wildlife technician for the DNR. Did that job for a good share of his career. It's great to have him with us. His book is funny and in many parts because there are a lot of stories that he has to tell, but also gives us an idea of the span of time when he was working and the evolution of the of wildlife and the Department of Natural Resources and the emphases that it may have placed along the way. Really fascinating read, but also you literally laugh out loud at times in this book. Kim in Whitewater has a question. Let's go there. Kim, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Jeff, I have been keeping track of the wolf conservation battle that's going on right now. Several years ago, the hunting trapping season proved almost disastrous results, and I'm kind of curious as to what your feelings on this subject are.
Wolf conservation, Jeff. Comments, yeah, interesting stories in the book about wolves.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I do have a chapter on wolves.
Yeah,
it's entitled "Howling with Pam," and I'm pretty well dug in on the wolf management situation. I'm interestingly, I'm the co-chair of the Conservation Congress Wolf Committee. I used to be on Sigurd Olson Institute wolf. Timberwolf Alliance Council, and I'm also on the Green Fire Wolf Committee with Adrian Wiedemann, and the Wisconsin Chapter Wildlife Society Wolf Committee. And I unfortunately got to work with both Dick Thiel, our first wolf biologist, and Adrian Wiedemann, our second wolf biologist. I can tell you right now, it's quite a political ordeal. But first and foremost, I want to say we are so lucky we have wolves returning to Wisconsin. I remember those early days when we had, 7 or 8 wolves. This is in the Dick Thiel days. Then we got up to about 15 to 20 wolves, and then we fell back to 8 or 12 wolves. And, you know, we were hit with parvovirus, with mange, with distemper, and no way did we ever believe we would get to 1,000 wolves, which we have today. And I think we're very lucky to have them. On the Conservation Congress, I have constituents here in my county who want every wolf dead. They say it's destroying our deer herd. And on the other hand, I have other people that want protection forever for wolves. All I can say on it is I know our wolf biologists pretty well. We have Jen Tack and Randy Johnson in Rhinelander. They've written a brilliant, I think, wolf management recovery plan. And I think wolves are here to stay. I hope we get back to state management. And I think our people in power at DNR understand all the controversy around wolves. And I think we're lucky to have them. It's an important part of our biota. And you can go from there. You'll get 100 different opinions, but yeah, they're here. I think they're here to stay. Oh, and one other thing on wolves. Dick Thiel said in a book when I worked with him, he said, we'll be lucky if we ever see 150 wolves. Adrian Wiedemann said, you know, with our road density, we probably can't have that many more wolves. That will control our population. Well, guess what? The wolves have fooled us. But we've been fooled before. The turkeys have fooled us. We have turkeys all over northern Wisconsin. We had no idea we'd ever have. So I think the wolves will win on the end, and it'll be fine. I hope we get state management, and I think we got a great plan, and it'll get worked out.
Kim, thank you so much for calling. Those names that you were talking about, Dick Thiel and Adrian Wiedemann and Keith Warnke, so many of the names in there are people that I've interviewed over the years about these various topics, and especially about wolves. So, Kim, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. There are so many stories. You have at least three, I think it's 3 chapters on bear. And you...
Yes.
I think you handle over close to 300 bear during your career. And you had some really great tales about bear. The one that I thought was hilarious, I don't think you ever told anybody about it. I think you said that in your book until you put it in print, or at least too many people, about a female bear that you had roped around the neck as part of a project, and it wound up in quite a situation.
I probably don't have time to tell that story. It's quite an elaborate story, and it's quite a bit of drama in there, as you alluded to.
Yes.
I do have 3 chapters on bears. And not only was I in charge of animal damage and control and abatement of bears in 2 counties up here along Lake Superior, but I had over the years 7 different graduate students from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, that I worked with on and off, either doing the denning in the winter, or I provided them bears for the research project, or taught them how to foot snare bears and whatnot. Bears are very fascinating animals. And one of the stories I may have time to tell is one time I got a call from a man in Springstead. Carl Morose was his name. And he called me in the morning. He says, Jeff, come right away. Come immediately. I have a terrible problem here. I have a bear right outside my door and he won't leave. He's pinned my wife and I in our house and we can't get out. And something is wrong with this bear. And he says, don't forget to bring a gun. Well, I jumped in my truck and I did put my gun in. And I drove as quick as I can. It was about a 20-mile drive to Springstead. And when I pulled in, I'm kind of pulling down a hill into his driveway, and there, he's right, there is a bear right on his front steps. But then I looked, and right next to the bear is a garbage can tipped over with garbage all over. And then I look over to the left, and on the side of his garage is a chain link pen with a black lab on it that is barking full volume. And then I carefully looked up, and there's a deciduous tree right next to his porch, and there's two bear cubs in the top of it. Well, then it all added up. So what I did was I went in and first disarmed Carl, unloaded his gun, and the bear had run off. I then got the dog. We got the dog out of the kennel and put it in the basement, and then we went into the house and just waited patiently. Within about 20 minutes, the female bear came back out of the woods, went up to the tree, made some calls to its cubs, and they started backing down very slowly. They almost got to the ground. They got scared, went back up. But within about a half an hour, 45 minutes, the cubs were down. The bear was reunited with its mother, and they descended into the woods. So, you know, that's just one shorter story from the book. But I did have a lot of fun with bears. The university work was very important to us because one thing we lacked in our population model was productivity. In other words, how many cubs are we reproducing each year and how cub survival is going? Because we needed that part of the population model in order to set a management goal, population goal, and a harvest goal. If you're going to remove bears through a harvest, you want to know how many you're producing. Well, the answer to that can only be achieved in one way, and that is to radio collar a female bear, follow it to its den, go down in that den and say, oh, there's two cubs, there's three cubs, there's four cubs, and then go the next year, because bears only breed and produce every other year, and count how many yearlings have survived. So those seven grad students really provided, from University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, really provided us with a lot of good data. And hey, our bear population took off. In 1979, Bruce Kahn, our bear researcher, thought we had about 6,000 bears. Today, Jen Tack and Randy Johnson over in Rhinelander, their population model states we have 25,000 bears. So bears really took off, and they're at this point one of our most sought after big game species.
Breaking in north of Highway 51 with us. Let's go there. Breaking, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, well, many things, because this, what a great guest, Jeff. It's very bizarre and oddly similar. I grew up on the Milwaukee River. We cleaned up the Milwaukee River back when I was young, and I was a counselor.
Oh, we lost. We lost.
But
oh, here he is. I am sorry. Bregan's breaking up, so we're not going to be able to keep him on, but I'm hoping he's still listening. He wants to know, how can he volunteer for osprey research?
Good question. Right now, I'm not aware that there's that much banding going on. I'm kind of out of the circle on that one. But we did, in my career, in my time, between myself, John Olson, and my second boss here at Mercer, Bruce Bacon, who has a master band banding permit, we've banded now over 500 nestlings. We've actually hacked ospreys into Iowa, and they now have a viable population. So, and our osprey population actually is doing pretty well right now. We had about 80 birds in the 70s when we had a problem with DDT or organochlorides. And today, I'm looking at my notes, in 2016, we had 558 pair nesting. So ospreys in general have recovered well. We've put on color numeral bands and followed their and track their routes. They basically leave Wisconsin, go down through Cuba and on into Central America and down to South America. We've got band returns from as far away as Peru and Colombia. And so overall, our ospreys are doing quite well right now. And once they've recovered, they're now off the both a threatened and endangered list. So there isn't as much effort now and as much need to band them as we had in the early years when we had questions unanswered.
Yeah.
But so I'm not aware of anybody banding them right now. There may be a few people doing it, but I'm not. I know we don't band eagles very much here in Wisconsin either, because they've had similar success in recovery.
So I guess if Bregan wanted to volunteer for something, it'd probably be some kind of a note to the DNR asking if there's anything going on through their website, I would guess.
Sounds right.
Yeah, that makes the most sense to me. Cheryl in Berlin, we'll go to you. Cheryl, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yes, I have a question. Are there elf owls in Wisconsin?
Elf owls.
Well, now I'm not aware of that. That's a question for my good friend Sumner Madison down in down at the Bureau of Endangered Resources. But I really couldn't tell you. You could go through. We have a wonderful society of Wisconsin chapter of the wildlife of the. I'm sorry. We have a Wisconsin Ornithological Society that would know that. I know up in the north, you know, we have our saw-whet owls, barred owls, and great horned owls. But, and we get a few snowies in the winter, but I'm not aware of that species.
I'm not aware of it either, Cheryl. Tim and Marinette will go to you next. Hi, Tim.
Tell you a story about the time I was downhill skiing about 30 years ago with a guy who was a big time hunter, and down on the hill was a 10 point buck and two doe in a pen, and Mark starts to go meh, and I said, what is that? He's what's a deer? So I go meh, and he goes, wow, you do that good, do that again. So I go meh. That buck looked up at us and he turned his head all the way around. It was facing backwards, and he snapped his neck as hard as he could, and he broke his rack off right there. And it fell in the snow. It was like somebody hit a bat on a tree. It was so loud. And a little bit of blood came out, and the two doe came over and kind of nudged his rack with their nose. And Mark just about fell out of the gondola. He's like, oh, my God, did you see that? He intentionally did that. I says, yeah, I thought they just fell off. He says, no, he snapped it off. So then about 3 years later, I'm at a Packer game, and I see Neil, the zoo curator from Green Bay, and we're tailgating, and I go over to him, and I said, hey, I said, when I go to a zoo and I see a buck with a rack when he shouldn't have one, I said, what's with that? And he said, well, you know how we do that? I said, what do you mean? He said, when that buck has that rack, we castrate him. He'll never lose it after that. He's now a show buck. I said, you're kidding.
Comment on that, Jeff. You worked with a lot of deer aging and so forth over the years.
Yeah, I was, and I also worked with Tim Lewis, who's an Orrin Ronstadt student, who had a deer study going over near Mellon, Wisconsin. And by the way, there was a gentleman up there named Martin Hansen. He was a man that had a lot to do with our elk reintroduction to Wisconsin, and he actually had on film a picture of a buck doing just what that gentleman said. He had it where the buck shook its head and the antler flew off. But I do know that when white-tailed deer are artificially fed corn or other supplements, their antlers stay on them longer than normal. To witness what he saw was extremely rare.
Yeah, extremely, extremely rare. Well, you've gotten involved. In fact, you, and by the way, I want to give a shout out to Terry Dalton, your wife, for the wonderful illustrations in your book. John Bates, I know, had a little blurb in the front of your book talking about Terry's work, but there's some beautiful illustrations in the book.
Well, that's a good point. Here's what John said, by the way, and John's a great friend of ours. I love reading Wrong Tree, but I also love the illustrations. Great art is the perfect complement to great stories. Kudos to Terry Dalton for her fine eye. Well, Terry's illustrations are, well, actually, Terry's standing right next to me. Let me have her tell you about these illustrations. One other thing I was going to say about them is what Cornerstone Press at UW Point that published the book pointed out to me is, Jeff, this is not only a memoir of your and a history of resource management over a 30-year period in Wisconsin, but this is also an art book. And, you know, one of the places we have the book is this art gallery in Boulder Junction, Moondeer Gallery. And I took the book to the proprietor, Sarah Moondeer, and she said, I don't really sell books here. I only do art books. Then she opened the book and she says, oh my gosh, Jeff, this is an art book. In fact, I'll take 10. And she sent all those 10 and ordered 20 more. So we'll let Terry tell you how these illustrations came about. There's a, if she'll step in front of the mic here for a second. And there are about 30 illustrations that are remarkable, and they really do make the book incredible.
They really do. And Terry, we're kind of running out of time here, but I want to thank you so much for the work that you've done. It really is a beautiful book.
It was fun working with Jeff, but I won't take up a lot of time. People can get the book and see for themselves.
And how do people get a copy of the book? I mean, it's available, but I know you can order it online.
Wrongtreebook.com will get you to a lot of sites that sell the book.
And I know you've got some appearances coming up in July and in northern Wisconsin. And so it's Wrong Tree. What is it again? Give me that.
Wrongtreebook.com.
Wrongtreebook.com. That's the place to order a copy, or go to your local bookstore and they'll ask for it, and they'll find out and get one to you. And we have your address as well on our page, the Larry Mueller Show page, under today's date. Jeff, I wish we had more time. Maybe we can do this again and talk some more, because there's so much more to talk about. And I'm telling you, that's the story that you have of you with a bear all by yourself, and the bear is roped around the neck, and how you got that rope back is a great story just in and of itself. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it, Jeff.
Well, thank you too, Larry. It was an honor being here.
Oh, man, great book. Jeff Wilson, the title of the book is Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology, and there are many, many, many stories that you're going to enjoy reading about in his book. Coming up, we're going to talk about woodlands here in the state, forest lands. A lot of them are privately owned, and we'll talk about managing them, and if you have some woodland, come to us with your questions, because our next two guests know a whole lot about trees and tree management. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.
Grace Bennett has always dreamed of moving to London, but the preparations for war that she finds on her arrival are not what she expected, and she certainly never imagined she'd wind up working at a dusty old bookshop nestled in the heart of the city. Through blackouts and air raids, Grace discovers the power of storytelling to triumph over even the darkest nights of the war. Join us for The Last Bookshop in London, today at 12:30 on Chapter Day.
Today on Central Time, the U.S. saw increased attention to public health efforts at the beginning of COVID and less attention since. An epidemiologist says that's a common cycle of panic and neglect that leaves us less prepared for the next disease. That's today on Central Time.
Explore how lasers can help combat cancer and how soil can lead to the discovery of new antibiotics in PBS Wisconsin Education's newest resource, Meet the Lab, an online collection of educational resources for middle school science classrooms. Funded in part through the Timothy William Trout Education Fund. The full collection is available for free use by teachers, educators, and families at pbswisconsineducation.org.
Support for WPR comes from Wollersheim Winery and Distillery, offering a variety of family-crafted wines and spirits. Wollersheim is a WPR Business Cornerstone sponsor, providing innovative, multi-year funding for future programming.
Stay connected with WPR on your smartphone or tablet with the WPR app on Google Play and the iTunes App Store. It makes it easy to listen to WPR Live and read recent news stories. You can also hear WPR programs on demand. WPR is everywhere.